would like to introduce our special guest, Carla R. from Tuhunga.
Hi, everybody. My name's Carla Rell, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carla.
Ooh, that's nice. That works. I want to thank Michael for the invitation to come out and share with you guys tonight. I have great affection for this group, and I've seen a lot of you I've known a lot of you for years and watched your kids grow up, and it feels good to still be here. We're still ticking. We're still here. And I hope if you're new that you find a love or an affection or something that keeps you here long enough to start to observe those things, to forgive and grow up and love. And I am one who subscribes to the fact that, or the idea that love is a verb. And I feel it and I see it when I come here to this group. And it's great to see Nancy and Mickey. And if this didn't work, I wouldn't be here. My sobriety date is September 25th, 1987. And if it didn't work, I wouldn't be here. And I just wouldn't. And when I got here, I didn't care if you were a glum lot. I didn't care about any of that. Paying rent for more than a month in a row would have been really fun. You know, living indoors for a little while might have been nice. And just stop the fighting and any of that. Keep my daughter. So if it didn't work, I wouldn't be here. And we have a lot of fun in here, and we talk about, I don't wake up on the sunny side of the street every single morning, but I do a lot more now. I wake up in the morning, and even if my first thought isn't yippee, my second thought is, and it's thank you. And I want to go out there and see what I can pack into the stream of life. That is my attitude many days, and that was not always the case. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad that I used to think it was my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family. If you had my family, you'd drink too. And I almost couldn't wait to give my sponsor my fifth step because I was sure she was going to go, no wonder, and all would be well. But she didn't do that. And I never want to forget the grace either. I want to say that. I never want to forget the grace because as all in as I have felt like I have been since I got here, I'm sure, like, even when I felt like I was given 150% and it looked like 60 to you, it was 150 for me, and God fills that gap every time with that sobriety math, that thing that when I give all I have, God fills in the blank. That's grace. That is grace. And I can't conjure that up. All I can do is open up for it. I had to sneak up on myself a lot when I was new and do things that I really didn't know if they were going to work, and they really kind of seemed stupid too. I did not want to come in. If I could have come here and stolen what you had, what I thought you had from these rooms and taken it home and done it there, I would have done it. I didn't want to get to know you. I didn't think that shaking hands and singing happy birthday were going to do much. I thought that you really had to be kind of social, and I'm pretty much an extroverted introvert, really. I like people for a few minutes. It's not even that I really don't like you. It's a lot. You guys are a lot. Because I want to think about me. And I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, and I've been around here long enough to know that my family didn't really, I'm an alcoholic because I have an allergy of the body to alcohol and an obsession of the mind for alcohol when I'm not treating it with the steps. That allergy of the body that happens when I'm drinking and the obsession of the mind for alcohol that happens when I'm not. And all by myself, I couldn't stop. And even when I stopped, I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I ended up in that torturous state of alcoholism where I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking all the time. And I started young. And I know we come in here from all walks of life at all ages. You know, I know many people came in here having built and lost great empires, you know, by the time they got to Alcoholics Anonymous. They had some success in their life. And that was not my story. I peaked out at about 11 and a half and skidded along the bottom until I was about 29. You know, that's when I got sober. And you know, like there are some people who had charm childhoods. My husband is one of them. And he likes you to know he's 3 months longer sober than me. He loves those sobriety countdowns. And when they do them year by year, because it's just 3 months, you know, so sometimes we have to share. But he, you know, he comes from a loving family. I mean, they didn't have to go to class to figure out how to love each other or anything. You know, they grew up singing together. And, you know, his dad painted the family pickup the same colors as his high school. You know what I mean? Like, they were that family, you know. I mean, after we leave, we still, to this day, when we get together for a holiday or birthday dinner or something, we leave, I've got a little bit of a sugar headache. You know what I mean? Because it's just so sweet. And that was not my family. Yet, he sits right next to me in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because alcohol did exactly for and to him what it did for and to me. That's why. That's it. And so you can boil down all the circumstance, all of our circumstance, our stories are funny and tragic and all of those things. But when you boil it down to what alcoholism is, we all had that. We all came to that point where we're either drinking or thinking about drinking all the time. And maybe you're just a potential alcoholic. Maybe you're just at the very beginning of all that. But if you can see that pattern, welcome. You don't have to ride the train all the way to the end. Although if it's still working, you know, for me, that was happening, you know, to and for me when I was very young. So why would I do that, you know? And I believed in God. And I'm not one who will call the spiritual thirst alcoholism. I don't call it that. I don't think a spiritual thirst is a sickness. Lots of people have a spiritual thirst, but what I quenched it with, you know, that was the deal. And even when I stopped drinking, the things that I tried to quench it with, you know, when they're faulty, when my dependencies are faulty, they just, you know, it's just nothing but trouble. So I believed in God, but when I discovered what alcohol would do for me, I began to let it. You know, alcohol was, I could pray and I could have a drink, and drink was so much quicker than a prayer, right? You know, it's just like, I didn't have to figure anything out, what's God's will, any of that stuff, you know, and I always kind of enjoyed wondering what that was, but I could take a drink and I'm good now. And alcohol became my spirituality, and it was my growing up muscle. It did all the growing up for me. Alcohol interceded in my life in a way that nothing else could. It was a thing that buffered me from you, and it was a thing that connected me to you, the thing that made me feel connected to you. It did all of that. So I began to let it. And I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle when I was like 11 years old. It was that summer between 6th and 7th grade. I was going up into junior high, and I was at my friend Leonard's house, and we were playing a game of spin the bottle. And the bottle we were spinning landed on me. We were passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey, and I went off to the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth, but every sponsor I've ever had has told me that the fair is in Pomona and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get for fair. So, you know, and I had already grown up with these. A lot of stuff happened in my family and in my childhood that I did not understand. I created these ideas. It was the 60s, so you add that on top. I was 12 in 1969, so the 60s that I liked were over by the time I got out in the world. But there was, you know, they talked about free love and all of this, and this combined, I just had these ideas about all that I imposed on the world, and I couldn't change. I just I just didn't. So I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for in junior high. And boys my age were looking at me funny, and so were the girls. And little by little, I began to let go of my life, my social life. I fought for a while, and then I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom and hanging out with the other girls who were doing the same thing. We bring stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets and hang out until after a while school just wasn't working for me anymore. And school for me had been my last bastion of refuge. It had been where I went to make everything okay. Stuff was not right at home, and so now it's not right at school. And I am a terrible spectator in my life. I am a take charge kid. You know, I am going to take over the management of my life, roll up my sleeves, and we are going to get it done. And way back then, my favorite place to be was on my way to somewhere else. I love that place. You know, it just seemed like I was doing something about my life. And I started to be found on the on-ramps of the 10 freeway going east and the 101 going north, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else. I love that feeling. That feeling for me felt like the bottle in the glove compartment. Like I didn't even have to have that thing open to already feel better. And consequently, because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hot spots, like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central Juvenile Hall. And we did that whole dance for a while. And they sent me home to mom and home to dad. And then the courts took over. And when I was 14, I left home one more time with a friend of mine. And we got one long ride all the way up into a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area where, you know, we're feeling very lucky. We're just little kids, bright lights, big city. You know, we got there. The guys dropped us off. And we were standing there in North Beach, and we looked to my left, and there was Carol Doda and her flashing boobs in neon. And to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps. Oh, my. And we weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talks about in the chapter of The Doctor's Opinion in our big book that after a time we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic lives seem the only normal one. And that already I'd become normalized to a life that I really, you know, I haven't had to know in a long, long time. And I didn't know it at the time, but I had already begun to trade away every God-given gift or potential or talent that I had for the effect that alcohol produced. And if you had asked me back then, I would have told you I was doing it willingly. It just seemed like the next indicated thing. And don't tell me not to drink. I wish I could have looked my dad in the eye over and over and over and told him things are okay. Things are going to be okay. It's all just fine. I'm not going to drink again and have it be true. But it wasn't going to be true. And after a while, I just quit saying it. It doesn't matter. Alcoholism just doesn't care who you love or how much you want it to be okay. Alcohol's got to be in there. And a year later, I was admitted to a mental hospital. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks observation, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And they were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism. It wasn't a treatment center. It was a mental hospital. So a lot of my roommates had some real illnesses, real manic depression, real schizophrenia, the real deal. And those things stand above, beside, and beyond alcoholism. Some people have both, but those are different things. And untreated, when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, I look a lot like them. It takes a little while to sort that out. So in the meantime, they're giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmain Sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I become intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I look like at 15. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy was the boys. I loved all the boys, but my favorites were those sexy smoldering types, you know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer, and you just never really knew when they were going to blow. And I love those guys, you know, just I used to find them very exciting. Now today I know that feeling is fear, so I stay away. But the trouble with guys like that in the nut house is that they're usually in there hiding from a junior prison sentence. They don't want to go to California Youth Authority, so they're trying to lay low. They're in there trying to, you know, divert, and they can't. They got nothing, so eventually they blow. Like my first boyfriend ended up blowing up and throwing a big chair through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit, and my next boyfriend ended up throwing a nurse through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit, so that was progressive too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on, right? You know, like maybe one day Bob Dylan following me around singing a ballad, you know, Tangled Up in Blue, you know, just setting the mood. And maybe another day a mariachi band, you know, just a little fiesta. Oh, God, you know, and maybe another day just flat out rock and roll, you know, because it's just like that, you know, just days. We used to play those sentimental jailhouse songs like, "Who, when will I see you again?" And press our little faces up against the big bay window of the girls' unit, looking out at them, looking back at us. Living in that sweet spot of anticipation. You know what I'm talking about. Right there in the if only. As soon as I get that, life's going to be good. Right? It's never in the getting it. The actual getting it, you go, "What was I thinking?" But in the middle, right there. I remember one afternoon I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. And he's the one who threw the chair through the window. He's gone. I'm never going to see that guy again. And I am devastated because this had been a real relationship, you know, 2-3 weeks or something, you know. And it was just, you know, because Nuthouse love, you got to get it done, you know. Just, it's intense. And I'm watching him and smoking my tragic cigarettes and channeling Greta Garbo. And just inside the girls' unit, I could hear Diana Ross singing a top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," then just walk away. Oh. Oh my God, it took me a long time to realize I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. Because it's the way I saw my life. I was always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. I didn't understand. And I was not unfamiliar with church or spiritual principles even, but I could never just hang on to them. I could never apply them in my life. Some challenge would come down in my home, and I pulled the shade down between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. I did that. You know, so I started looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. And the trouble with doing that is that I'm always about half a bubble off what it is I think I see anyway. Like, I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. I mistake brute strength for strength of character. And those are just some. And I get them in my hot little hands and they dissolve where I stand because they're not it. I had to come to AA to learn that it's when I'm thinking of you, constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. That's what makes that illusion of separation disappear. That's what lifts that veil, pulls the shade back up. And I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the unit where they put the patients they just don't know what to do with anymore. And every now and then I'd get thirsty enough to where I'd find my way over the fence or under the gate or however I had to do to get out and have a party for a week or two. And then I'd come back in, I'd be tired, come back in the front door of that place. Why? Because that's where I lived. I lived in the nut house. And by the time I got to that last unit, I was no longer bathing or getting dressed because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house. And I had casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I had been cutting, and that was just a different way of dealing with emotional release. And I didn't even know that then. And somewhere along the line, I had begun to surrender to the thought that maybe I am just one of those little nut house lifers who gets to get out every now and then, but I'm always, always going to end up back inside. Why? Because every time I go, I hit the street, I am right back doing the very thing that got me locked up in the first place. And I have no idea how to stop it. I'm just doing the best I can. Alcohol for me was a solution for a long time. And then it did become a problem. I'm not somebody you're going to hear say alcohol was not a problem. And my big book never stops talking about alcohol being the problem. And that's what's at stake and why I continue to do a 10th and 11th and 12th step. 10 is 1 through 9 all over again. 11, grow that relationship with God. And 12, share it. That's why I continue. I sat last night and my husband had Doug, you guys know Doug. He had a commitment last night sharing at an anniversary party out in San Fernando. And I had a new person with me trying to get back. She'd lost 12 years, 12 good years. This lady was active. This lady had it and then didn't do it anymore. And that's what is at stake there. So drinking is what's at stake. That first drink, if I ever take one again, I can never safely take alcohol in any form at all. I'll never be so spiritually fit that I can afford to take a drink of alcohol. I just won't. And so I don't ever want to forget that. But I was sitting next to this lady last night, And she was just like Lori talked about, you know, every raw, and just like I felt, every nerve ending just hanging off, and the microphone was very loud. And every time they spoke through the microphone, she'd jump, and she was sweating, and she was drinking water and trying to hang in there and trying to stay in her seat. And I was holding her hand, and she was here. There was a room full of people, and she felt all alone, all by herself. And she almost couldn't stand the sound of everybody's voice, almost. And she knew she loved it. She could hear from a distance, and she's sitting right in the middle, and she could hear him from a distance and couldn't touch him. And I saw it, and it reminded me. And that's what sponsorship is all about. The juice, like you said, the juice of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another, the basis of our fellowship. When I see that again, it brings it all back from the guts up, from the inside out. What a privilege to sit next to her and hopefully hope that she stays and holds my hand and sits through it. And the deal was, as sick as she felt at the end of the night, she said she wanted to go back. So, you know, thank God, because it's been 4 years trying to get back in. And if you're new, or if you're having trouble, if you've gone out, you are always welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is never let anybody shame you for coming back into Alcoholics Anonymous. The trouble is, the question is for me is, can you stay? Can you come back in across the threshold of AA and get enough traction to come in here and be with us again? God, it's painful to watch. And it's why I stay. I'm hanging on to you. Thank God, thankful to the people who walk before me with 30 and with 35 and 40 and 50 years. Thank you for staying, no matter how boring it got or how sick of it you got and how many personalities we don't like anymore and how much AA has changed from the time you was, you know, all that. You know, and I've gotten ready to say it. I haven't said it completely out loud yet, but I get there and I watch, but I have to watch the old timers and say, you know what, they're still here. They're still here. It's still working. And I was locked up in one place or another during my adolescence. I was always sitting in front of a judge, it seemed, waiting for placement, you know. My dad used to say, I think they're just trying to buy you some time, Carla. And maybe they were. Maybe I was lucky. I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. No alcohol or drugs involved. She was just done. She swallowed 3 bottles of pills on a very dark day, and she was done. My baby brother died of alcoholism and drug addiction when he was 30 years old. And he was done. He had been in and out of prison, and he had lived his life. And I believe that sometimes God just lets the really tired ones go home. That's just how I see it, you know. And my mother died of end-stage liver disease about 9 years ago. And my last remaining sibling lives in Wisconsin. And when she's not drinking, she lives on the Vicodin maintenance diet. And she's not interested in AA. So I don't know how I got so lucky, but I'm glad they hung on to me long enough for me to find you. It's the only thing that's ever worked. In all those places that I was ever locked up, and there were several, if I ever learned anything while I was there, I left it there when I left. And Alcoholics Anonymous has something for some reason. Either I was, when you were delivering the message, I was ready to hear it, and I was ready to do something. I was ready to get into action. And every time I leave this room, Alcoholics Anonymous goes with me. It goes with me. It is with me everywhere I go. I ran away from the last place I was in, and you know, I'm the kind of a drunk who sleeps by the side of the road and calls it camping. Really, you know, I think I'm on a spiritual quest, and I'm a hobo. You know, because truthfully, I mean, really, in Los Angeles, when I'm in the city, I'm a street walking hoe. That's all I know. You know, that's how we're gonna get it done. That's it. When I'm out on the highway, I'm a gypsy. You know, I mean, alcohol lied to me in a way. I lived this life. It created and preserved illusions that allowed me to go a long way. And I drink on those illusions and delusions. And I hooked up with another guy. I moved up with a couple of friends of mine. They rented a house in Eugene, Oregon. And I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere new thinking, let's go screw this up too. You know, I always went somewhere thinking, you know, fresh start, clean slate. We're going to get this right. We're going to do it right this time. And, you know, two things happened while I was up there. We're going to get back to the land. And you know, again, I'm from L.A., you know, so I don't know what I thought I was getting back to, but I like the idea, right? And we planted a little garden in the front yard, and that's where I learned that when they talk about hoeing, they meant with a tool, you know, it was just a different thing. But two things happened while we were up there that I certainly couldn't see while it was happening, and our book talks about that too, many of us showing symptoms and signs of alcoholism long before we're ready, willing, or able to do anything about it, and it was already happening. There'd be days when we'd go without booze, and I was a terrible thief, and I'm trying to lay low. I don't want to go back to lock up anywhere, you know, so we go without booze, and when I've got no booze, and I've got no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, no sufficient substitute, I am restless, irritable, and discontent. My relationship with alcohol already so developed that when you take it away, I got nothing. And when I could drink the way I needed a drink, I was always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17. I couldn't guarantee if I was going to have 2 or 22. And that was already in play. My friends had asked me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. And I moved in with my dad against his better judgment, and we lasted just a couple of months. And he came to me, and he had to ask me to leave. And I know it just broke his heart. But he said, I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. It was right before my 18th birthday, and all I could remember is that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard, and there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there. And I was 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of Papa vodka, and I would just go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was survival, and not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name, and 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name, but I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my 8-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. You know, he'd been nothing but kind to me, did nothing but try to be nice to me, and man, in 6 short weeks, I ran through his life like that proverbial tornado, you know, physically, spiritually, mentally, materially, and all he did was try to help, and so he was on my list, and I was always glad. My first inventory, I don't know about yours, but mine was not perfect. I was just not ready for all of it, you know what I mean? Thank God for the 10th step, because the first one, you know, it was a lot like, your fault, me, you know? I couldn't swallow it all, and but he was one I got, and after I made that first round of amends to my family, that declaration that continues to this day, I mean, to follow up, I never want my mother to, or well, my mother never had to worry about where I was anymore, and my father, I never want him to, he never has to know, worry about where I am. He always knows. My daughter knows where I am. She doesn't have to worry about why did my mommy leave. My grandkids have never seen me drunk. That kind of thing. But after that, I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety looking for this guy, you know, because I just wanted to see if I could make that right, whatever it was going to be. And of course, I couldn't find him. And my sponsor finally said, you know, you're going to have to leave that alone. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. And, you know, there's some, you're just going to have to leave it alone. You're kind of chasing your tail. And, you know, so keep doing what you're doing. You're doing well, you know, and, you know, try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Go ahead and do that. And you know, to tell you the truth, when I got here, I didn't need a lot of convincing in that direction. That's not in the big book, by the way, but it's a really good idea. You know, just get your feet, you know, get your feet. And I didn't need a lot of convincing in that area, but because I knew what I was. I knew you couldn't use the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. I knew that when character met comfort, I was always choosing comfort. I wanted to be stand-up, and I couldn't. And I knew I wasn't going to be before I did what I did. And I wanted to be different, and I couldn't. And I needed examples. I needed to see how that worked. And I loved my first home group. I loved that for that, because every day when in the book study, they talked about how they applied what was in the book to their lives. In participation meetings, they talked about how they applied these spiritual principles in their daily life. They'd have tangible examples of what that looked like. So right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. I said I'd be there, and I'd show up, you know, and I love that. I love that to this day. It's really quite a trick, you know. It's really kind of, you know, showing up when I said I would. And I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't... But don't dare not invite me. You know what I mean? You got to invite me, but I'm not going. That's how it was. And so showing up is always this thing, you know, even if I'm afraid, I don't have to stay home, you know. And so I go and I give that talk, and of course I felt better. And right after the meeting was over, the thank you line came through, and this man stopped and he said, "Where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I with almost 13. Now, only a very well-organized spirit of the universe could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done on my own steam, just couldn't make it happen. And even if I could have in some way made that come together in my first year of sobriety, he wasn't sober yet. Maybe he wouldn't have gotten it quite the way he did when he had some time. So, you know, that's not the biggest amends story you're ever going to hear. It's not even the biggest one I have. But I love that it took so long. You know, I love that I just let it rest and it came to me. I was willing. I believe that spirit attracts spirit eventually, you know. So I got to take him to dinner and make those direct amends, and we had a long talk, and after it was over, he said, "Oh my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." And he's right, you know. I think if we're in this room tonight, we're the lucky ones. And I say lucky because I believe that God's grace rains on everybody. We all have an opportunity, but are we going to receive it? Are we going to receive it and then get up? And even if you have to sneak up on yourself, do it. You know, go pour some coffee. Even if you don't feel like it, sneak up on yourself and go shake someone's hand. Sneak up on yourself and say hello. You never know what will happen. And I had to do that a lot. It felt like everything new that I had to do felt like I was holding my nose and closing my eyes and jumping in. But I had to. I was saving my life. And you know, you can call it willpower, whatever it is, sneaking up on myself, but I had to do something I didn't feel like doing. And I'm living proof that you can be in Alcoholics Anonymous for 9 months and not feel like being here and still have it work. You know, because I didn't, that horrible obsession to drink did not leave me till I was about 9 months sober. And incidentally, in the middle of making my amends. But somewhere along the line, I realized it had been a few days since that horrible obsession had been on me, you know. And for me, I don't know what obsession for alcohol sounds like you. I'm not talking about, I mean, Calvin Klein made billions on obsession. And obsession is not good for anybody, you know, to have that. But I'm talking about obsession for alcohol, where that lullaby of rationalization is ra-da-da-da-da-da, singing me a song about how it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, just have a little drink on the way to the meeting, a little drink at the break, it's okay. A little drink on the way home, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. You know, and after a while, that little voice sounds like that kid following his mom through the grocery store wanting chocolate. You know what I mean? Like, "Mom, mom, 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 mom." And I used to think I had to drink to shut that up. But I don't. And I'm not going to tell you I didn't sit on my hands a lot. The obsession was not lifted early for me. And so whatever you have to do until that internal conversion, now you got to get on the steps. I highly recommend you get on the steps. I highly recommend you start working with people. Highly recommend getting in the car. Highly recommend coming in here and sitting with us. I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day and working my little job, answering phones. But something was happening, you know, even while the obsession to drink alcohol was happening, something was happening. There was a willingness, there was a change, there was a hope, there was something happening. And I knew it was in these rooms. And even though I knew that, in the beginning, I'd sit outside and I'd get to the meeting maybe an hour early and I'd sit in my car till 5 minutes before the meeting started, trying to get something up to go inside and sit way back by the exit sign in the open door. And be with you, because for that hour and a half, oh my God, I heard the hope. Let's just say, you know, again, I'm going to just skip forward to, you know, I ended up having this little girl, and we were living in a shack way up on a mountain with a plastic roof, and it was just, I had this little girl, and I thought it was going to change the way I drank, and, you know, And I drug that kid from pillar to post. I had to leave him because it was just violent. You know, we just couldn't, we both drank, and he was a little more violent at the time than I was. Three beers, and then we'd be in it, and we'd be on. And I would take it for so long, and then I'd come back, and it was just like that. And I had this little baby, and I want to be a good mom. But up till then, I'd been kind of institutionalized, and I hadn't been able to live outside the shadows, live off the side of the road, live in the real world. And so now it was time, and I drugged that kid from pillar to post, And my first legitimate work was in the bars, and it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? And it seemed to me to be cosmically efficient, you know. And we went from state to state and back down out in Covina. I was renting a room for my aunt out there, and I had a job in Hollywood tending bar, and it wasn't a bad job. It's just me. I'm the common denominator in there. And my daughter's almost 4 years old by then, and every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye, and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood, and I'd get thirsty about Arcadia, and I'd pull in off Huntington Drive, and I'd pull into the first cabin, and I'd have my afternoon shots of Cuervo Gold and Budbacks, and get up, you know, get right and get up and go pour drinks with everybody in Hollywood till the wee hours of the morning and start all over again. And one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye like I had done for months, and I started off for work, and I got thirsty about Arcadia again, same thing, Huntington Drive, first cabin, shots of gold, Bud Backs, and to this day, I don't know what was different on this day from the day before except for 24 hours, because I didn't hate the job I was going to, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool that day, and I drank those drinks, and this time I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction. And I sat on the bar stool, and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area until I fell into another job at another dive bar. And I had to stop calling the kid to find out how she was doing because she kept asking me those hard questions like, Mommy, when are you coming to get me? And I didn't have any answer for that. In fact, I knew in my heart of hearts that she was better off where she was. And I met the man I would marry in the next bar where I worked, and we were drinking buddies, and I thought, maybe if I made my life look like yours, and that was it. He and I got married about the time we should have split up. We became the neighborhood entertainment. Settle our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever gets to the gun first wins. That's how we roll. And I went to my first AA meeting with black eyes and broken ribs, and not the first time. And I went there feeling very sorry for myself. And there was a woman speaker. That's pretty much all I remember, except that the one thing I heard her say was that somewhere during her drinking career, she switched to beer. So I did. Because the representative from Alcoholics Anonymous recommends that we do. And I, like Lori, thought beer wasn't really drinking. You know, it seemed to me was more like a whole grain breakfast food. You know, it had hops and barley and... It gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. It allowed me to get a little further into my day before I fell apart, and it just went like that. And I got the kid back for when she was 8 and a half, and I didn't get sober till she was 10. So we drug her through a little bit more of that, and we were all, my husband and I and my daughter were living in a little apartment across town in Pasadena, and one more Saturday afternoon, the cops are in the driveway one more time, and the neighbors are watching us one more time, and it's me and the kid and the booze, and... I can't stop what's happening. Nobody got up that day thinking, let's do this, you know. And the cops left. They took the gun. The husband left for the last time. And I can't stop drinking. And here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, you know, I'm really tired of this. A hard drinker might say, you know what, I might even need a little help. Go to detox for a week or two. And they'd come home. They'd go back to work, have a story to tell if somebody asked them. They would move on. That is a hard drinker. But me as an alcoholic, what I did was I just pulled the 12-pack closer to the couch so I didn't have to keep getting up. Because I drank through my circumstances. I drank through drug addiction. I drank through homelessness. I drank through the circumstances of my life. And if I were to start, I'd drink through them again. You can just line them up. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. If I wanted to just, you know, because it wasn't like I didn't believe, but I just never could establish and maintain that relationship with that power. And now it was time to test it out. It was time to call that power to its promise. And I did it through you first. You were my first big higher power. And then it had to be something bigger. Because sometimes the phone doesn't. Sometimes people can't answer the phone. Sometimes the line was busy. Sometimes I can't reach you, and there has to be something bigger. There has to be something that's with me. But it was gradual. And my book promised me that I could start with the willingness. And later on, the promises came true of that step, that the consciousness of my belief was sure to come to me, and it did. And I continue to draw near. I love. All I have to do is ask. I mean, for me, step two just means maybe, 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 maybe. That's all it had to be. I didn't have to be any more than I was when I got here, or know any more than I knew. I got to start from where I was. I was 12 step by my next door neighbor who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the first coincidence I could count. You know, those situations that seem to fall together for the good of everybody without me having my hands on it. And she came over and 12 stepped me, and about a week and a half later I got sober. I went up to my first meeting, and I stayed sober 89 days, and I drank one more time and had to finish that drunk, and then I went up. My sponsor came and picked me up. I'm so glad she didn't say, "No, too bad. Strike three, you're drunk." No. She came over, helped me throw away the bottles, and took me to the big book study that night. Now, I wasn't disruptive. I just sat in my chair. Somebody at the break came up to me and asked me if I wanted to come and make coffee on Tuesday. And I thought, dang, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. And I came on the days in between. And I started taking the steps with a fervor and an earnestness. And I've changed and over the years and survived things. And, you know, my daughter went through a bunch of stuff when she was 11. She was an angry kid, and no wonder, you know, she was an angry kid. And from the time she was 11 till about 23, you know, there was a long period of reconstruction ahead. We set the intent to heal the relationship, but then the healing took time. You know, even with my family, and to this day, there's not one member of my family who, we were talking about this at dinner, there's not one member of my family who will stand in the doorway and say, "No, please don't go to the meeting." You know, none of them ever do that. You know, that never happens. You know? And now that kid, she's 40 years old. She just turned 40 this year, and just a few years ago, I got to sit with my new husband, and I was 51 years sober and 21 years old when we got together, so hang in there. I'm so glad that you guys taught me that boyfriend or no boyfriend, husband or no husband, my circumstances don't dictate the quality of my life, nor do they dictate my ability to stay sober. All those things are nice. Lots of money, no money, whatever the circumstance, they don't dictate the peace of mind. They don't dictate my peace of mind. They don't have to. They can. I have let it, but it's up to me. And so I sat with my husband and my family, and we watched her collect her master's degree just a few years ago. And she's a clinical social worker on the crisis impact team for a police department. And she's one of the people who goes in after those tragedies, like the terrorist act out in San Bernardino and the Las Vegas shooting and all that. And she goes and sits with the families in the aftermath of that and helps them begin to put the pieces of their lives together, back together. And it's not lost on me that she's adept at crisis impact after long exposure to me. But I don't know. I don't know who she is because or in spite of me, whether it has anything to do with that. But I know that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to be a privileged witness in her life and in the lives of those who invite me into theirs. And she had two of the most beautiful boys. My oldest grandson just started law school this month, and my youngest grandson just started his junior year in high school. And I'm just Grandma Carla. You know, I'm just gray-haired Grandma Carla. And I like it like that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm there when they need them and when they need me. And my father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. He sleeps well, and he knows why. He has a great affection for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love my husband. I love the life that we have. Like I said, both of us were... I was 21. He was 22 by then. And I think we hit the jackpot. You know, we have an AA home, and when women come over to work with me, he gets out of the way, and when guys come over to work with him, I get out of the way, you know, I just feel so fortunate. But I've had to do some stuff, you know, and you know, not everybody's going to like, you know, not everybody's going to like me. Not everybody's going to, you know, it's going to be just like life. Whoa. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, alcoholism was the catalyst. Alcoholics Anonymous was a vehicle that drew me the map into the fourth dimension. And like my friend Hector says, Alcoholics Anonymous is not the only thing I do, but it is the first thing I do. My whole entire life is built on a foundation of 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts. But I've had a life I would never have known to ask for. And all the time, you know, and I don't believe that God showed up. I believe that God's been here all the time. You help me wake up. God doesn't show up, I wake up. So I'm going to stay and continue to do this and keep waking up and hopefully stay there. And if you're new, I hope that you'll do the same. Thanks for letting me share.